Here's a question that every one of us faces every day. The question is, what do you do? We face choices every day. What do we do? Because those choices have the capacity to affect our witness for Christ. What do we do? Well, this series is centered on that question because Jesus chose to become completely human when he came to earth. That means he faced all the difficult situations that we face in life. He struggled with all the ethical issues, all the temptations that we face. Remember back a few years ago, the What Would Jesus Do bracelets were a big fad. Well, the Gospels, I believe, go beyond that. They don't ask, what would Jesus do? They tell us what Jesus did. And so they form a guidebook for how Jesus handled life. His responses are a blueprint for what we should do when we come face to face with the same issues and temptations and situations. What do we do? Well, we begin this series by looking at how Jesus dealt with the pressure to step outside of God's plan and timing. How did he handle the intense pressure to do things the way that other people thought they should be done? How did he handle the pressure of other people's expectations and still remain true to God? John chapter 2 is where we're going to start. We find Jesus facing that pressure to step outside of God's timing and then finding a creative way to resolve the dilemma in a way that glorified God. So if you're looking at your series outline, if you're able to download that, the first thing that we look at is the temptation. If you've never heard the stereotypes about Jewish mothers, here's a letter that just about covers all of them. It starts out, "Dear darling son, and that person you married, I hope you're well. Please don't worry about me. I'm just fine considering I can't breathe or eat. Oh, the important thing is that you have a nice holiday, thousands of miles away from your ailing mother. I've sent along my last $10 in this card, which I hope you'll spend on my grandchildren. The Lord knows their mother never buys them anything nice. They look so thin in their pictures. Poor babies. Thank you so much for the birthday flowers, dear boy. I put them in the freezer so they'll stay fresh for my grave. Which reminds me, we buried Grandma last week. I know she died years ago, but I got to yearning for a good funeral, so Aunt Minnie and I dug her up and had the services all over again. I would have invited you, but I know that woman you live with would have never let you come. I bet she's never even watched that videotape of my hemorrhoid surgery, has she? Well, son, it's time for me to crawl off to bed now. I lost my cane beating off muggers last week, but don't you worry about me. I'm also getting used to the cold since they turned my heat off, and I'm grateful because the frost on my bed numbs the constant pain. Now, don't you even think about sending any more money, because I know you need it for those expensive family holidays you take every year. Give my love to my darling grandbabies, and my regards to whatever her name is. The one with the black roots who stole you screaming from my arms. Love, Mom." The Jewish mother stereotype. It generally involves a nagging, overprotective, manipulative, controlling, smothering, and overbearing mother or wife. One who persists in interfering in her children's lives long after they become adults. Margaret Mead once described a Jewish mother as, quote, "a woman intensely loving, but controlling to the point of smothering and attempting to engender enormous guilt in her children via the endless suffering she professes to have experienced on their behalf," end quote. Now, I share all that with you because that stereotype ties in with some of what we see going on with Mary, the mother of Jesus, here in John chapter 2. The context is a wedding, which was generally a large celebration. It was filled with family and friends. John tells us the wedding guests included Jesus' mother, Mary, and Jesus, and all of his disciples. Now, the problem came when the wine ran out. Verse 3 tells us Mary immediately went to Jesus with the news. It's a simple statement she made. They have no wine. Now, notice Mary carefully phrases this statement, so she isn't directly asking Jesus to do anything. She's more subtle than that. Jesus' response shows that he gets the message pretty clearly. Verse 4, and Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." Now, I don't know about you, but that seems like kind of a dishonorable way to approach his mother and to answer that statement of fact that she gave him. But that's how we respond. Now, to understand that response, I think we have to look at the backstory. When Jesus was born, there were only 6 adults in Israel who recognized him for who he was. Zacharias and Elizabeth, they knew the truth early on, but they were advanced in age beyond their childbearing years at that point. This is 30 years later, so they're most likely dead. Simeon and Anna knew who Jesus was as soon as they saw the baby brought into the temple. They were both advanced in age at that point, so they're also most likely dead. We aren't given any information about Joseph after Jesus' birth in early childhood. He's really never mentioned again, so the implication is he's gone also. The only one who's left at this point who truly understands that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, is Mary, who is probably somewhere in her early 40s when this wedding takes place. Now, can you imagine what it would be like to carry that knowledge around for all those years without being able to tell anyone? Mary was a normal mother. She loved her son with all her heart. She was proud of him. Like any other mother, she wanted people to know how great her son was. But how could she tell people the truth without appearing to be delusional? You can almost hear the other mothers responding to her. "You think your Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God? That must mean my son is the high priest." See, no one would believe her. The only one who could reveal the truth and make it believable was Jesus. So, verse 3 is a message of impatience and intense motherly pressure. They have no wine. Peer pressure is hard enough to resist. Pressure from your family, especially from your mother, that's even harder to resist. This is Mary coming up to her son and subtly suggesting it was time to get the show on the road. She knew who he was. She knew what he could do. He could end her suffering of having to carry around this secret by revealing himself to the wedding crowd and miraculously creating wine for them. He should do this for his mother. Wouldn't any of us want to do whatever we could to make our mothers happy, especially when they're pouring on the pressure and the guilt that way? Well, in that context, Jesus' reply makes perfect sense. He isn't responding to the fact that they ran out of wine. He's responding to the pressure to reveal himself as a son of God at that particular moment in time. Verse 4, he says, "My hour has not yet come." And when Jesus asks here in verse 4 still, "What does this have to do with me?" he's saying, this isn't the right time. This isn't the right place to make that revelation. Well, he could have made a big splash. He could have been a front page headline in the Cana Gazette by creating wine in front of everybody. But that would have put all the focus on the miracle, and none of the glory would have gone to God. So Jesus told her, "My hour has not yet come." there would be a proper time and place for Jesus to reveal his power and glory. But this wasn't it. You see, by focusing on the bigger mission, Jesus was able to resist the temptation that was created by his mother's intense pressure. The temptation was to step outside of the Father's plan and to push the timing ahead for his own glory. And that was a tough temptation to deal with. And I think that's why Jesus' response in verse 4 seems so abrupt. He's drawing some pretty strong boundaries in the face of temptation. Well, that leads us to the resolution, beginning of verse 5. With all that having been said, Jesus was still faced with the pressure. Like all Jewish boys of that day, Jesus was raised to honor and respect his mother. And so it was a huge breach of culture to not respond to a mother's request. See, Jesus was duty-bound to respond in some positive way to his mother. And Mary knew that. So her response to Jesus' somewhat reproachful statement was, she just didn't listen to him. And that sets the stage for him to do a miracle. Verse 5, his mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now, Jesus had just told her, it's not the time, it's not the place. She just bulldozes right through that. She says, "I know my boy. He'll do right by his mother. So you servants listen up. You do whatever he says." The dilemma is to honor God's will and timing and to still honor his mother's wishes. Mary wanted Jesus to do something so special people could see who he was. Well, the solution is Jesus does a miracle, but he does it in a very unassuming backdoor kind of way. The passage tells us there were 6 stone water pots sitting there that were used to hold water for the ceremonial washing of the guests. When the ceremonial washing was complete, the water pots were emptied. Now, these were large pots. They held probably 20 to 30 gallons of water each. Jesus told the servants to fill the pots with water once more. Verse 7, Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." And they filled them up to the brim. Notice that. They filled them all the way to the top. And then without any special motions or display, Jesus next told the servants to draw some of the liquid out and to take it to the head waiter, who had to be sweating over the fact that he had not ordered enough wine. Well, the head waiter took a taste of the wine and he couldn't believe what he was tasting. At the end of verse 9 and the end of verse 10, it says, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you've kept the good wine until now." Well, the quality of water in that day could never be assured, so it was safer, and it was a common custom for everyone to drink wine mixed with the water. Normally, wine was diluted in this case to a pretty good ratio to where it was mostly water, but the wine was just there to purify the water. So it was impossible to get drunk on this. At a wedding or any special event, the good wine was always served first. When everyone had drunk freely of the good stuff, gotten somewhat drunk, then the regular, heavily diluted wine would be brought out to finish the celebration. Well, the testimony of the head waiter is that Jesus created the good stuff. This is pure, undiluted, high-octane wine. Now, I want you to go back and look at this and see how Jesus resolved the issues he was facing. It was important that he maintain God the Father's plan, that he not get ahead of the Father's timing for his presentation. So Jesus did this miracle in about as low-key a way as could possibly happen. Verse 9 tells us even the head waiter didn't know where the wine had come from. The only ones that knew were the servants who had carried all the water and they weren't telling what had happened. So there was no great unveiling of Jesus' glory and power here. Jesus maintained his submission to the Father. At the same time, he respected his mother's wishes, and he honored her. He didn't create just any wine. He created the good stuff. This was pure, undiluted wine, far and away better than even the good wine that had been served at the beginning of the celebration. Mary may have only expected the diluted wine since they had reached that point in the celebration, but Jesus made the best stuff anyone had ever had. In a review of C.S. Lewis's biographies, Ralph C. Wood made this comment. He said, C.S. Lewis may have become the chief Christian tutor to the 20th century because he refuses the perennial temptation to turn the wine back into water. That tells me it's tempting to water this miracle down, to pretend that Jesus never touched wine. But the truth is, we need to avoid temptation. We need to realize Jesus made the best wine ever made. And then Jesus went beyond Mary's request to supply wine, because there were 6 stone water pots, each one filled to the brim with water. If we take the smallest amount that they would hold, Jesus created 120 gallons of this excellent top-of-the-line wine. Now, the largest amount, he created 180 gallons of the good stuff. He not only answered Mary's request, he went above and beyond, and he created enough wine to keep the entire wedding party happy for more than a week. Mary was impatient with God. She wanted everyone to know the wonderful truth that she had always known about Jesus. And she wanted it to happen sooner rather than later. She wanted people to honor her son. So she pressured Jesus to step ahead of God's plan and timing and to reveal himself at the very beginning of his ministry. How many times do we face that same pressure? How often are we tempted to take things into our own hands, to do them in our own strength, because God doesn't seem to be answering and we get tired of waiting? What did Jesus do? He honored God's plan and timing. He refused to give in to intense pressure, even when it came from his mother. He refused to walk ahead of the Father's will. He lived in submission to God. And the result of that is seen in verse 11. It says, "This is the first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him." So it brings us back to our original question of what should we do? Well, we need to have the discipline and the faith to do the same as Jesus. We need to acknowledge that God's plans are always better than our plans. And we need to have the commitment to live in submission to him, to walk like Jesus walked. In his autobiography, Buck O'Neill tells of being a black man who played professional baseball before African Americans were allowed to play in the all-white major leagues. By the time the color barrier was broken in 1947, Buck O'Neill was considered too old to play in the big leagues, as were most of his teammates. Many of his friends grew bitter about the missed opportunities. But listen to what Buck O'Neill writes. He says, "At a reunion of Negro League players in Ashland, Kentucky, a reporter from Sports Illustrated asked me if I had any regrets coming along as I did before Jackie Robinson integrated the major leagues. This is what I told him then. Waste no tears for me. I didn't come along too early. I was right on time. I don't have a bitter story. I truly believe I have been blessed." The title of Buck O'Neill's book reflects his cheerful optimism, his belief in the sovereignty of God. Despite missing out on fame and fortune, O'Neill chose to title his autobiography, "I Was Right on Time." One mark of spiritual maturity is that we resist the temptation to do it our way, in our time, and we accept God's timing, and we realize God is always right on time. Whose time are you living by? Are you living by your time, when you think things should happen? Or are you waiting for God? Are you trusting in God? Are you believing in His sovereignty? Are you living according to God's time? Pray with me. Father, help us to learn what it means to be submissive to your will. That means we walk as Jesus walked. We don't get ahead of you. We don't push things to happen in our time. We wait for you to do them in your time. And we trust that you will do them in your time. And we live in a way that allows you to glorify yourself through us. Because when all these things take place, people know it's not us, it's you. Lord, let people see you through us as we walk like Jesus walked. We pray in His precious holy name. Amen.